Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks so much for listening to Connecting Faith. Programs like this are possible thanks to listeners like you. You can find out more about supporting Faith Radio on our website, faithradionet.com.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hello and welcome to Connecting Faith, a very special edition today. I'm excited to introduce to you two sisters and a powerful story to tell. And it is appropriate that on this day when we honor the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that we hear about some of those who were engaged with him, sort of arm in arm in battle, as it were. And it truly was a battle in many cases. The racial tensions around Birmingham particularly, and bombings and kidnapping attempts and lots of threats and all those things as it relates to one family particularly. And we're going to hear the untold story of Arthur Shores and his family's fight for civil rights. And there's a new book out called The Gentle Giant of Dynamite Hill, and it's written by sisters Judge Helen Shores Lee and Barbara Sylvia Shores. And they're both on the line with me. Ladies, welcome to Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having us on.
Let's start with this. You know, these events that we're talking about back in the 50s and the 60s in Birmingham, Alabama, particularly. You know, having lived with this, I guess, quote unquote, story all your life, how were you impacted by going back to retell this account?
It was an interesting journey to go back and retell and relive many of the memories that we experienced as children. In particular, there were things that I learned from my sister Barbara that I was not aware of that happened when we were growing up, because when I was 16, I left Alabama and going off to college, and Barbara remained. So when you read about the bombings and everything, I never realized until we sat down and started talking and putting the words to the page that our dog Tasso, which was a little maple brown cocker spaniel, was blown up, and that she went looking for him and found him in pieces in the yard. I mean, so there were things that I learned that I didn't know, and I'm sure there's some things that she found out in terms of what I was feeling and doing that she didn't know. And it was just a great experience to go back through that and actually to relive that time again.
It was almost like a cleansing effect, too, because we lived through those events, and it was at a time that we really didn't talk about them a lot. They happened. Parents didn't talk about them. Children didn't talk about them. And Helen and I, during the time, did not talk about them. And it was going through the writing of it and reviewing everything, it was bringing up a lot of old feelings that I thought I had buried long time ago. But then to bring them up again, it was like a cleansing that I went through, which I'm very glad. And it was like a renewal that I went through, which was good for me.
As I was reading through the book, I was thinking, and have read other things, activities and events around this time, thinking, you know, you were just adolescents, you know, 10, 12, 14 years old. Did it seem normal for you as children? And I'm wondering, I guess, maybe Judge Lee, when you moved away, but was it many years till you kind of look back and say, you know, that really wasn't a normal childhood?
No, and indeed it was not a normal childhood. It was different for us. Not only was it different because we were black, but we were also different because our father handled so many high-profile civil rights cases, and our lives were in constant danger. I mean, it was not unusual for bullets to fly through the windows of our house on a regular basis, and we had a routine that we followed, you know, when that happened. You know, in growing up, we couldn't, as young teenagers, give out our telephone number, because of the threats that were always made against, you know, our family. And, you know, Barbara can tell you about an attempted kidnap of her from elementary school. So it was everything but normal in growing up.
But even though they were not normal, our parents, I think, did their very best to add some normalcy to our lives. We both took ballet, we took dance, we went to the recitals. My parents were at every recital, every dance recital. We had other things that helped to sort of balance out things. My father, every week, would take us to the movies. If he was out of town, he made sure that he was in town on the weekend, where we had a routine of going to the movies every Saturday, stopping by the local drugstore to get ice cream. So even though it was not the normal where Helen liked to socialize and date, that was sort of cut off a little bit. Not so much for her, but for me. So that part was not normal. And as she was saying, we couldn't give out the telephone numbers. We were not allowed to walk home from school, which Helen broke that rule. She would dodge the people who were to pick her up, and she would walk home with her friends. So that part was not normal. But, again, the parents did a lot to try to add things to make a balance for us in our lives and growing up.
Sounds like there might be another book here someplace about the Helen story, but anyway.
That's very true.
Well, you know, a lot of us, you know, we only know a name or two from this era in our nation's history, and maybe just to introduce us to Arthur Shores and his part, and, you know, give us a little framework setting for the life in the racial tensions in Birmingham back in 50 years ago.
Well, you know, a lot of folks think that civil rights started in 1963 with the marches and the hoses and the police dogs and everything. But long before 1963, our dad was handling civil rights cases throughout the state of Alabama. He was not the first African-American attorney in the state, but for a period of about 11 or 12 years, he was the only practicing African-American attorney in the state of Alabama. He handled his first voting rights case in 1939 and won that case in terms of voting rights for blacks. He went on to handle discrimination in salaries among black and white teachers in 1942, and he went on to win that case after case, whether it was zoning ordinances, voting rights cases, integration of the University of Alabama and other school systems here and in North Carolina. A lot of these cases were handled long before 1963, when civil rights really became popular.
And that was one thing that we wanted to get across in writing the book, too, that he was like a trailblazer in the early 30s and 40s doing all of these cases and winning the cases. And as his profession progressed, he became one of the lawyers for Martin Luther King, Shuttlesworth, and others.
I'm sure most of us can't really comprehend that this, living in this kind of racial tension, it really, as I, you know, read about it, I mean, it seems like it was an everyday constant issue of pressure. I mean, you talked about, you know, not uncommon to have you know, bullets flying through the windows. And, I mean, just literally it was relentless, wasn't it?
It was. And we had a routine that we had to follow when that happened. As a young child, I couldn't completely understand why people would want to harm us. I mean, what had we done so terrible that you would want to kill us or harm us? And so there formed in me a lot of resentment and discontent at what was happening in terms of the laws here. If there was a law that told me I couldn't drink from the fountain, which is one of the Jim Crow laws, we had segregated water fountains. I was going to drink from that fountain. You know, if there was a board on the school, on the streetcars that designated what section blacks could sit in and what sections white could sit in, if there was no room for me to sit, but the space up front was empty, I was going to move that board. And I did, as a young child, 8, 9 years old. And, of course, I was scolded time and time and often got a spanking when I got home for doing that. But I was challenging those laws long before the laws were changed.
We're learning today about the gentle giant of Dynamite Hill. This is the untold story of Arthur Shores and his family's fight for civil rights. And here we are as we are around the 50th anniversary of the civil rights movement. Yet, as we just heard, it really was going on long before that time, and so we're getting some of the backstory, and we're going to find out more in just a moment as we continue here on Connecting Faith. Judge Helen Shores Lee is my guest, and her sister Barbara Sylvia Shores. They're the children of Arthur Shores, and giving us their perspective. They've co-written a new book called The Gentle Giant of Dynamite Hill, and we'll continue in just a moment with more here on Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. So glad to have you tuned in today as we learn more about the amazing story, really, of a family determined to fight against the injustice of the time. And it was prevalent, particularly in Birmingham, Alabama, where so much of the civil rights unrest was centered. The Gentle Giant of Dynamite Hill is the untold story of Arthur Shores and his family's fight for civil rights. And we're hearing from Judge Helen Shores Lee and Barbara Sylvia Shores, daughters of Arthur Shores, to hear more about the story. I'm interested. Did you read the papers and watch the news and wonder, were the stories misrepresented? I mean, as you were kind of growing up, and I think you were saying a little bit earlier, why were people so mad at you? What had you done? But did when incidents happened, I'm assuming that maybe the reporting wasn't all particularly accurate or full.
Well, we didn't do a lot. I don't know about Barbara, but I didn't do a lot of reading of the newspapers. And as she said earlier, our family really never talked that much about it. We've talked to other children of the movement, and it's interesting. It's as if the parents wanted to protect the children from, or protect us from all of that. They never really, it was not the topic at dinner table. It was just not a topic in our house. We knew that my dad was involved in various legal work in as to trying to gain equality for blacks, but the exact nature of all of that work I didn't understand until I was older and started going to court with him and witnessing, what he was doing. And it just made me even more resentful that people would want to hurt us. But the first time I realized that I guess there was really a difference between the races was we had this big amusement park here called Kittyland Park, something like Coney Island. Big amusement park with Ferris wheel, carousel, you could smell the cotton candy and popcorn. And as we took Sunday rides, which we did every Sunday after dinner, we'd get in the car and we'd just ride through the different neighborhoods to see what new construction was going up. It was just a Sunday ride after dinner. And invariably my dad would go past this amusement park. And you see the kids running and playing and riding the carousel, and I would holler for him to stop, and he told me he couldn't stop because we couldn't go there. Barbara and I couldn't go to Kittyland, and I didn't understand why. And he told me that only white children could go there, and I would throw my usual temper tantrum and fit, and eventually, you know, cry out that I wanted to be white, because if I was white, I could go to Kittyland. And in his, you know, very calm voice, you know, he would just reassure me that we couldn't go to Kittyland right now, but one day we would be able to go to Kittyland Park. And, of course, I never had or got the opportunity to go to Kittyland, but my sons did on a trip back here from California. My father informed me that he had taken them to Kittyland Park as very young children. Mm. So it was different for us.
Barbara, did you have some of the same, resentments or anger? How did you maybe express your feelings during that time?
I was a lot younger, and I can always remember when things would come up. It was usually centered around Helen's resentment to what was going on, but I can always remember my father having a teaching lesson as a result, as he would scold Helen and tell her why. And one thing he would always tell me was that things would be better and things would change. He said it may not come as fast as we would want it to come, but that he believed in the legal system, and he was working hard to make things better for everyone. And that was what I really believed in. Helen was the one in the family, I think, who was the more sort of assertive, aggressive one, and I was more sort of quiet and the one to sort of listen a little bit more, I think. And our personalities were different, but they sort of still complemented each other. Helen was my protector. Even when we were growing up, we, as a club, we had in our neighborhood. And Helen, of course, was the president of the club. We had no other officers except Helen. But Helen was the one who would sort of monitor the neighborhood kids coming into the neighborhood and everything, and monitor our little club groups and everything. And she was the big sister to sort of act as a protector towards me. So I didn't have the fear. The only fear that I can really remember having, and at the time having feelings of hate, I guess, was when the house was bombed. The first time the house was bombed, the only one here was my father at the time. And I can remember my mother and I had gone to the movies and coming back home at the time. We got within about 6 blocks from the home, and I had never in my life seen such a wave of people, mobs just sort of throwing rocks and bottles and policemen shooting up in the air. And we had to walk from one street to about 5 streets until we got to the house, and my mother was extremely upset. And when we reached the house, part of the house, one section had been blown up, and we found my father okay. And that was at the time that I found my dog, one dog dead, and the other one I never found. And that was a frightening time for me. And then in less than 2 weeks, we were all in the house, and to talk about how the media would write things up. Well, after the first bombing, the media wrote that no one was injured in the house because they were at the other end of the house. So what they did the second time was to plant the bomb at the other end of the house. And at that time, I was there in the kitchen, and all at once, this huge explosion again, and I knew to hit the floor. But I think my heart was in my mouth, and I was crawling trying to get to my parents because I was the furthest away from them at the time. And as I got to my father first, I saw that he was okay, trying to get the door open that had been blown inward, and I went on to my mother and found her on the floor unconscious. So that's something that still lives with me. For a long time, I could close my eyes, and I could still smell the stench of the dynamite. Mm. during those times that we had the bombings, everyone in the house flew out, not only here at our house, but within about a two-block radius. The next morning, you would see glass companies coming to replace the glass from the windows that had been blown out. But that was one of the most fearful times, and a time where I did feel, why is this happening to us? It was at a time when my father was not involved in a big case at the time. He had slowed down, and all at once this comes up and this happens. So it took time for me to sort of to understand that a little bit better, to get the forgiveness in my heart and to get over that fear. But to hear that noise and to smell that dynamite was something I'll just always remember.
The even as you say, at that time, Attorney Shores was not active in a particular high profile case, but there didn't seem to be much rhyme or reason, I guess, was there, in terms of the attacks that came on your family or many others, or churches or whatever it might be.
Well, what was happening during that time? They were getting ready to integrate the schools here in Birmingham, and he had been associated so much with cases like that that it was assumed that he was the attorney at that time. And we feel that that was why he was targeted, because the other attorneys at the time who were actually handling the case had not been targeted for the bombing.
Did your father know the important part that he was playing in this movement and maybe in this historic fight? Did he have a sense that this was something that was, history changing?
I really think he was just working to make a difference. He wanted to make a difference, and he didn't look at the limelight or anything like that. It's like, what can I do to make things better? And he believed in going through the court system. A lot of people were saying, you need to hit the streets and demonstrate. That was okay for that group, but for my father, he felt like going through the courts was the way to have the change.
Let me say this. Throughout all of, throughout all of those years, the bombings, the bullets, the hatred, I never saw him say an unkind word about the people that did this. Neither was he ever afraid, and that was something that was hard for me to understand. I guess, I had enough anger for everybody in the family, but he never appeared to be angry. He was always calm and soft-spoken, never raised his voice, but one who had an abiding faith in his God that he would see him through all of this, and of course he did.
We're learning today about the life of Arthur Shores, attorney in Birmingham, Alabama, and he was at the forefront of much of the fight for civil rights, as was his family, and we're hearing from his daughters, Judge Helen Shores Lee and Barbara Sylvia Shores, as they've recounted the story in the new book called The Gentle Giant, A Dynamite Hill, and it's published by Zondervan. And we're going to hear more from Barbara and Helen in just a few minutes. We want to talk about confidence in the law and government leadership, and talk about the role of the church and some of those things, and the connection to Dr. King as well. All those things we'll get to here in just moments as we continue with the Connecting Faith. Glad to have you tuned in today to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem, and my guests today are sisters. Judge Helen Shores Lee was born in Birmingham, Alabama, and has been a judge, and along with her husband, has two sons, a daughter, and five grandchildren. And Barbara Sylvia Shores, also born in Birmingham, to Arthur and Theodore Shores, and she's mother of adult twins, and she's been employed with the Jefferson County Office of Senior Citizen Services for 26 years, and presently the executive director, and the two of them have co-written this book telling recounting some of the stories of life in Birmingham. and particularly about the place that their father Arthur Shores played in the civil unrest and the fighting for civil rights. There was a kidnapping attempt, multiple bombings of their home, death threats, and much more. And this was happening, sadly, not that many years ago. And so they recounted this story in the book called The Gentle Giant of Dynamite Hill. And I'm wondering, sisters, you talk a little bit about that Attorney Shores decided he was confident in the law. Did he really believe that the law and even government leadership would do the right thing, that would win out in the end? I mean, obviously George Wallace was there blocking things and Bull Connor and all sorts of men in leadership positions that weren't certainly following any sort of justice, it seemed.
Well, he did indeed believe that the law would ultimately rule out many of the cases on the local level that he received an adverse ruling on, given the nature of the state in the South. If he received that adverse ruling, he just moved it right up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which gave him a favorable ruling and overturned many of the rulings here in the South. So he persevered, and that perseverance worked to his good.
He played a part in a time when Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. came to town and, in fact, ended up in jail. And there was obviously we're familiar with some of the writings from the Birmingham jail, which are perhaps most powerful and well-known of Dr. King. But your father played a role in that, right?
Yes, he did. He smuggled out many of Dr. King's notes that were written on scrap paper. He was one of Dr. King at the time could only be visited by his lawyers. And I think he was one of a couple of lawyers that were allowed to come in and visit with him. And they smuggled these pieces of paper out that eventually became the letter from the Birmingham jail. My dad also represented Dr. King, representing him in regards to the Montgomery bus boycott that took place in Montgomery, Alabama, and also represented him as far as he had been indicted on tax evasion, and my dad was one of several lawyers who represented him for that.
So many of us just don't know sort of all the names of what has taken place, but they're thinking somebody like Vivian Malone, maybe. Talk a little bit about her impact, who she was, and just a few of your friends and associates that you knew personally.
I met Vivian Malone. Dad was also the attorney along with Thurgood Marshall when Vivian Malone and James Hood were entering the University of Alabama in 63. I was in college myself at the time, and I met Vivian and James Hood when they would come to the house and talk about meetings and things like that. And I was really impressed with both of them. She was so tall and graceful. Very intelligent, and James Hood also was very, very vocal and very active and very intelligent, too, so I was impressed with both of them. Here at the house, we had visitors that, at the time, we just didn't realize how important they were. Thurgood Marshall was a frequent visitor here at the house, probably from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and even in the 60s, he would stay here at the house. When he came early on, he was Helen's horse. Helen was into cowboys and Indians, and he would get down on all fours, and Helen would climb his back and ride it like a cowboy. He was a horse, and she was a cowboy. So we had also Constance Motley, who was a federal judge up in New York, who also stayed, who worked on cases here at the house. So we had a multitude of different people coming through the house at the time that we didn't realize, you know, the importance that they would eventually become.
You know, the widow of Medgar Evers delivering the invocation at the presidential inauguration 50 years, I think, to the day that he was killed. I mean, it provides another opportunity to review history. Just what are some of your thoughts or reactions to, I guess, you know, opportunities like this that we have maybe nationally to remember the stories?
I think it brings attention, but I think there are so many young people who don't know who Mega Evers was, let alone Mrs. Evers. And I think, you know, that having someone of her caliber give the implication, there'll be a lot wondering, who is this lady? And then we'll be able to go back and review the history. They will learn something that perhaps they didn't know. That's part of my discontentment, is that so many of our young people are not familiar with leaders of the movement that existed before Dr. King and the part they played in all of this. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that by her giving the invocation, it will be an opportunity for us to go back in history again and review the part, not only that she played, but certainly her husband played in all of this.
I was thinking, too, I don't know if we want to talk about Alabama football at all, or if...
Roll Tide!
Okay. Because I know that you weren't always there at that University of Alabama, but, you know, it's you look at that the powerhouse program, and really it's... was there a time when you couldn't root for that football team because of, you know, what the university represented at the time before Virginia was able to or Vivian was able to attend?
That's quite true. We could not attend there, and it was just sort of taboo. The football game was there, but I also remember Paul Bryant, the coach, saying at one time he did not want any blacks on his team until he was whipped so badly by a team that had blacks. And after that, it appeared that he began to recruit blacks. And that attitude sort of changed. And although Helen and I did not attend the University of Alabama, my son is working on his doctorate now, and he's the only grandchild who is attending the University of Alabama. But we love Alabama, University of Alabama.
Okay. You can't help it, probably, anyway. But, you know, Barbara, I know you went to University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. And,
right.
Talk a little bit about what the maybe kind of what you experienced going from, you know, Birmingham to the middle of corn country in the Champaign. I mean, you made some of the racial perspective, I guess, from south to north.
It was a difference. And what I would tell people after I was up there for a while is that here in the South, you know how whites actually felt about you. But up north, it was sort of subtle. They pretended to like you okay, but they really didn't. So to me, the Southerners were sort of truer. You knew they didn't like you right off the bat. They did not try to like you. But as a result of being up there, I learned that they were all not like that. And some in my connections and in my work, I was in the school system there. The first school I attended, or at least worked there, I made some very good friends who came to visit me in my home, who attended my wedding. And we have visited each other over the years for a while. And so it changed my perspective because I had never been into an environment. I had gone to an African-American college, and then to go from a predominantly black college to a predominantly white college university for graduate studies, it was a big difference. It was a cultural shock almost, totally in the minority, but... attitudes were changing differently, and I did learn and make friends up there, white friends up there. I had as many white friends as I had black friends up there who I really considered true friends.
Do you think there's still some of those aspects today, this maybe a subtle disregard that we appear interested on the outside, but inside we're not? Do you think that's still a factor today?
What I try to do right now, it is a factor today, but what I try to do is look at every person as an individual and not to just sort of judge everybody by the way one person would act. And as such, I see and meet every person on an individual basis. And I don't look so much at color so much as to how that person might behave. That, to me, is more important than just the color of a person's skin.
Judge Lee, do you see some of those changes as well?
Yes, I see them. I see them every day. I see them in the courtroom. You know, I see them in other institutions that I'm members of a board on.
We're talking today with Judge Helen Shores Lee and Barbara Sylvia Shores, their sisters, recounting the story of their father, Arthur Shores, a civil rights attorney whose name is probably not familiar to many of us, and it should be. He's known as the Gentle Giant of Dynamite Hill. That's the title of a new book recounting the untold story of Arthur Shores and his family's fight for civil rights, and it's published by Zondervan, and we're going to continue in just a moment with Helen and Barbara. You're listening to Connecting Faith. This is Connecting Faith. We've had a great discussion today with Judge Helen Shores Lee and Barbara Sylvia Shores, sisters recounting the life and times of growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, and particularly the important role that their father, attorney Arthur Shores, played in his fight for civil rights. And the book called The Gentle Giant at Dynamite Hill is published by Zondervan. It's a great discussion today. Ladies, I'm interested. We haven't talked about the role of the church in your life, and maybe you remember some things about the preaching. Just be interested in some of your perspective about that key part of the community as you were growing up.
Well, in growing up, we were members of the First Congregational Christian Church, and what I remember growing up was every Sunday, my father taking us to Sunday school. I mean, there was not a Sunday that we did not go to church and Sunday school. So much so that when I went off to college, I went to chapel every Sunday because it had been instilled in me this going to church every Sunday. And so that was a part of our daily life. And a lot of the activities at that time in growing up took place in the church. We had a youth fellowship group that met every Friday night. And that was kind of where kids from the, not just the kids who were members of the church, but kids from the community could come together and fellowship together. We had something like Bible lessons initially. And then after that was over, we had a time to socialize. So we had a good group that met every Friday night. Now I think they refer to it as youth ministries and what have you. But youth fellowship met every Friday night where we learned of the gospel and of the works of Jesus Christ, and then we had time to socialize. So everybody looked forward to youth fellowship on Friday night.
The church was an important aspect of our lives, and even in growing up, we attended a Lutheran school where we had Bible studies every day in Lutheran school and studied the catechism and things like that. And we could always use those Bible stories, and we had sort of like an edge up on the kids at the church because we already knew a lot of the Bible verses, the Bible stories and everything. And as we grew up in the church as teenagers, I think the ministry and the sermons became, I don't know, with me, I just sort of attached to them a lot of times. There was a lot of talk about forgiveness, reaching out to others to help other people, doing what God wanted you to do, to be a good person and to be a blessing to others. And I think that's how I saw my father. He was being a blessing always to somebody else and never looking for anything in return. And I think Helen and I have both in our lives tried to be a blessing to other people as we have walked and journeyed through this life.
Maybe if you would recount a few, were there some little steps or maybe small cracks in the wall that that you saw that kind of led up to maybe major changes in the civil rights legislation and attitude and changes? I mean, your father, I assume, was involved in maybe many of those things that, you know, like you said early on, that we sort of think it happened back in the 60s, but there was a lot going on.
And there were a number of voters' right cases where blacks were not allowed to register to vote. They either had to pass some ridiculous test like recite the Constitution of the United States, and of course, you know, they couldn't do that. And my father tells the story of one of his clients that went to register, and they asked him to recite the Constitution. And he started out with the Gettysburg Address. He could recite that. But the man who was registering him to vote didn't know the difference. And so he let him pass. He said he didn't know that there was a black, that's not the word he used, but I'll use it here, in the whole United States who knew the Constitution of the United States. But and then you had the poll tax. You had all kinds of hurdles to get through. To keep you know, blacks from being allowed to register to vote. But once the Voters' Rights Act passed and these tests and everything was done away with it and they were registered to vote.
Are there some, just as you've, you know, put the book together and reflected on it, and I'm sure you had opportunities to talk around the country a bit about it, are there some, what lessons do you think we still need to learn today? And, you know, what, I guess, when you have the opportunity maybe to speak, what's the most important thing you want to pass along?
I guess one of the things we would hope to be able to pass along is for people to understand that, you know, we're all different. We're all different. I can respect your opinion if it's different from mine. But to be denied the same opportunity as what you have because of the, as Martin Luther King put it, the color of my skin rather than the content of my character is disheartening. And some of that is still out there today. We've come a long way in spite of all of the laws that have been passed. In spite of the legislative victories that have been won, we still have a ways to go for people to accept all people, regardless of race and your creed, to accept everyone as a child of God. Everyone is a human being. Everyone is a child of God. And we seem to have a hard time accepting that. We're not fully there. We still have a little ways to go. So I think we have to continue to work on it and to pray and to ask for God's guidance to help us get where truly we need to be.
And I don't think we can forget where we have come, how far we have come. I think elders have a responsibility to let their children know how we got where we are. So we won't go back to where we were at one time.
Are you optimistic, pessimistic, or somewhere in between?
I have to remain optimistic. It may not come in my lifetime, but certainly I'm optimistic that eventually one day, you know, people will be accepted for who they are.
Give me a little perspective about, what's Birmingham like today? I guess what do you see as maybe the challenges and the good things happening in the city that you called home for so many years?
There are some good things going on. Of course, I left Birmingham, but I eventually moved back here. And, I could see the difference, certainly, in terms of the changes. Everything is open. I mean, you can go where you'd like to eat, the movies, bowling alleys, what have you. But institutional racism is still very much alive and thriving, and I see that. It's not as obvious as it was when we were growing up as children, but I see it. It's still there. I see lawyers that come into court who are disrespectful. And some of the things that are going on in our educational institutions are a little alarming to me. When they named the Bell Tower down at the University of Alabama several years ago, I think it was a couple of years ago, after Arthurine Lucy, who was the first African-American admitted, my father represented her, admitted to the university, the campus almost rioted. There was a section that just went crazy with racial slurs. You would have thought we were back in the 60s. I think the university was embarrassed by it and really made serious efforts to put down the perpetrators of some of this. But you would think we'd be a little beyond that by now. But we're not. So, I try to work hard with my grandchildren, letting them know of their history, and hopefully, they will get involved. And I mean, they have friends across the board, both black and white. They don't see any problems, but I'm out in the community a lot, and I do see them, and it's a little disheartening what's going on.
Ladies, just maybe just a final word about what is a day set aside to honor the legacy and the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. What does it mean to you? How do you look at this day?
For me, it's going to be a day of service where I will go out and volunteer my services with some organization to help a group of people. And that will be my way to honor and try to keep his memory alive and try to really do something to help someone else at that time, and to not only do it that day but every day, to try to do an act of kindness or to do something to help someone.
Well, for me, I think it's very fitting that this year's inauguration takes place on his birthday, as we celebrate his birthday and take it in consideration. All of his speeches, the speech from the March on Washington, to see how far we have actually come, I can't tell you how gratifying that is.
You talked about, hanging on to the messages at church as a teenager, messages of forgiveness and reaching out and being a blessing. I mean, those messages are appropriate any time, but certainly if as followers of Christ, regardless of the color of our skin, if we would have applied those basic principles of the faith, the things could have been a lot different a lot sooner.
Absolutely. If we just would apply them today, things would be a lot different.
Ladies, it's great to talk with you, and we wish you wonderful days ahead. Thanks so much for the good work you've done in writing the book. I hope you've enjoyed it, and look forward to maybe hearing more. We're going to get Helen's story eventually, right? Isn't that right, Barbara?
Tell-all.
The tell-all book, yeah. We'll look for that one. So that'll probably be twice as big as this one. But no, the book we've been referencing is called The Gentle Giant of Dynamite Hill. It's the untold story of Arthur Shores and his family's fight for civil rights. And it's published by Zondervan. And we've heard today from Judge Helen Shores Lee and Barbara Sylvia Shores, both remembering fondly those good memories. Thanks so much, ladies, for...
We want to thank you for having us on your program.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for listening today to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Staples.